If you learn nothing else from this show, remember that friends do indeed come in all sizes, as do Arby's sandwiches. But mostly that first part, you know, about the friends and whatnot, yeah.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who were these guys?
Welcome back to Junk Food Cinema, Film School Rejects weekly cult and exploitation film podcast that's kid-tested and mother-disapproved. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, once evicted from an apartment on Sesame Street, and I am joined by my friend and co-host, novelist/screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How much does this man love you, gentle listener? He's recording the show on the anniversary of his birth. He's working on his birthday to ensure that you get to stuff your ear faces with cerebral junk food.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what's happening right now. That is a good way to put that.
Indeed. And I want to remind you that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter @JunkFoodCinema and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema.
I thought you were leading into a joke tied into the movie we're going to talk about today. So I was like caught off guard when you're actually talking about the anniversary of my birth. Yes.
I keep you on your toes, man. That is what I do here. That's my
right.
Job.
I'm rounding out my wonderful birthday sitting up here in the remnants of Rock Sauce Studios.
Yes.
And ready to record what might be our final broadcast from this very spot.
It might indeed. We may have to go mobile, like some kind of Edward R. Murrow.
Oh, I've got the Jeep from Pump Up the Volume that we can drive around in and record our podcast.
I think that sounds way more fitting than what we're doing right now.
Have Samantha Mathis drive us around.
I'm all for this.
Yes.
I'm excited about this plan and excited to be a part of it. Well, this week, we are going to test the theory as to whether tragedy plus time does indeed equal comedy. The tragedy that occurred a short time ago was, of course, this planet's losing Robin Williams. You know, this is obviously an event that shook a lot of us. I mean, this is a guy that's been a part of our lives in some form or fashion for several years, many decades, and the way we lost him is obviously very tragic. But we wanted to let some time pass. I mean, we were actually recording when we heard the news that he was gone.
Yeah, we had a marathon session of three episodes, and we come out, and everybody's like, "Have you heard?" And we're like, "Heard what?"
Yeah, we've been deep in the Junk Food Cinema vault for 3 hours at this point, kind of dead to the world, and then we hear this really awful news, and obviously the first thing we thought of is we need to do some kind of tribute, some kind of show honoring Robin Williams, but we wanted to let a little bit of time pass, and we wanted to, I don't know, not ride the rail of his demise, I guess, is one way to put it, not seem like we were trying to get a few more hits by talking about a man who had just so tragically departed. So,
and especially someone whose work we really enjoyed.
Absolutely.
Both you know, his underappreciated stuff and the stuff that many other people mention.
Yes, and owing to that, we all have our favorites of his films, and in fact, settling upon just one is kind of an insurmountable challenge. But that being said,
Moscow on the Hudson.
Prost. That being said, my very favorite of his comedies is unquestionably today's featured film, and that film is Death to Smoochie.
Smoochie's magic jungle, it's a happy place.
I watched this movie for the first time in high school and absolutely fell in love with it. And it wasn't really until I was going back and doing some research that because I was so young at the time, I really wasn't paying attention to the movie scene overall and definitely not reading the internet yet to get movie information. So I didn't know things like how disappointing this movie was from a box office standpoint. I mean, it was a tremendous, tremendous flop. I mean, it cost $50 million to make. It took in a grand total of $8 million and has a very vitriolic review by Roger Ebert, who says basically that this is a movie made by very talented people, because only talented people could make something this bad.
Well, and Richard Roper has one of my favorite cinematic slams of all time in regards to this. I wildly disagreed with him, but I thought it was hilarious. He while on the Tonight Show with Roger Ebert said, "This is a movie so bad, I'm waiting for somewhere like France or Germany to declare it genius."
Well, Roper, it won't be France. It may be these two chuckleheads sitting here in this building.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, it is absolutely my favorite of his comedies. And I also didn't realize that Robin Williams specifically was nominated for a Razzie for his performance in this movie, which, again, the Razzies not always with their finger on the pulse of cinema. I mean, this is an organization that tried to give a Razzie to John Carpenter's The Thing. But it is kind of shocking to me that he was nominated for Worst Performance, but lost out to Hayden Christensen in Attack of the Clones. Just a little bit of trivia there, so do with that what you will. But this is a film that I genuinely love on every single level, and it is part of, you know, Robin Williams surprised audiences everywhere when he appeared in, I guess what we've been calling his Dark Trilogy. And those movies are Death to Smoochie, Insomnia, and One Hour Photo. But what I didn't realize until going back and looking at them again, all three of those movies were released in the same year.
Yeah.
They all came out in 2002, with Death to Smoochie being the first, followed by Insomnia, and then One Hour Photo. And the Smoochie being the first to be released, I think that may have had something to do with the reception of this movie. I can only speculate, obviously.
Well, I was on the ground at the time. I mean, I caught a lot of hell for loving it.
And now you're just in the air. Just gravity doesn't apply to you anymore.
No, it was, you know, I was a young critic at the time, and I was a big fan of this movie, and there was a handful of us that really dug it. That you know, it had cult film written all over it, but we thought it was a pretty funny cult film, and I went head to head with a number of other critics who just thought, you know, I was out of my fucking mind for loving this movie. And you know, a bunch of us felt that we were alone, and then slowly over time we collected, and the cult prominence of this film kind of rose up, where, you know, over the years you'd start seeing people make Death to Smoochie references or bring it up in forums, and then other people are like, finally, other people get this movie. And it's just kind of swelled, and now it's one of those things that it's not so cool to say Death to Smoochie is a terrible film, and people are starting to re-examine it. Mm-hmm. And look at it, and those of us that liked it from the beginning are like, it's kind of fucking about time, you know, it's because this is a movie that's due. You know, you mentioned Robin Williams and his Dark Trilogy. The thing about Robin Williams, he did a lot of really cool dark comedies, and he really did some black, bleak stuff, you know, especially things like World's Greatest Dad. And
that was after.
Yeah. This. No. Yeah. You've got that trilogy there. But yeah. I was just referencing, you know, a lot of people think of most of his stuff as being light and happy and fun and poppy and very mainstream. And he did the mainstream stuff and then would turn right around and do something just that was really risky and dangerous. And sometimes it worked out and sometimes it didn't. And for Death of Smoochie, it didn't work out, except I think it's really, really, really fucking good.
Yeah. And I freely admit that what I love so much about just the central conceit of this movie is that the thing I love most in cult and exploitation cinema is sort of when filmmakers have the audacity to really subvert innocence and good. I mean, it's the reason that Black Christmas, or for that matter, Silent Night, Deadly Night, are among my favorite horror films. Because I love the idea of taking something so pure and something so innocent, something especially that we loved from our childhoods, and just doing something like the comedy almost comes from how dark you go with something that is supposed to be so pure. And, you know, with comedy especially, I like the idea that there is nothing that can't be mocked, lampooned, or made the target of satire. And Death to Smoochie is about the corruption inherent in big business, which is not a revelatory concept, except that it focuses on children's television as that big business.
Well, I've always felt that this is kind of a soul sister to Shakes the Clown. You know, that this is, you know, it is one of the things that I love about this film, and what I love about Shakes the Clown, is it takes a ridiculous premise about something we know exists, and then takes it so seriously that you get invested in this crazed drama about it. And here we have this show, this movie about this children's show with these children's icons doing very serious behind the scenes battles with one another just to decide who is the top children's performer and right. who gets to have the show. And they take it so seriously, and there's such weird stuff that goes on in the background with assassins and bribes and craziness that it just, you can't help but just fall into this weird, bizarre, quirky little world.
Yeah. And I love the idea that the oddity in this movie, the real oddball character, is Edward Norton as Sheldon Mobes, aka Smoochie the Rhino. And he's such an oddball, and he's almost drawn as a cartoon because he's the one incorruptible person in the whole storyline. And the idea that not only is children's television corrupt behind the scenes like any other big business, but that the one person who is irrefutably good is such an oddball character, is such the out there character. He's such an outlier for this world that he's almost drawn as a cartoon. Like he still says things like, gee golly, and how do you like that? And like, it's not just that he's good. He's like, he is a remnant of, you know, the Leave It to Beaver era.
Which is what I think so many people find inaccessible about this film, is that, you know, there is, you know, there's no real character to grapple onto, because the person who's good is a fucking idiot, and everyone else who's smart or wise, you know, are selfish, terrible people. And so it's really hard for some people to get invested in that kind of a story. And I get that. I enjoy the sick satire of it.
Absolutely. And I think that is actually relatable if you think about it. I mean, if you've ever kind of come into any venture, any arena you're not familiar with, and you feel like you're the one person who isn't getting ahead for whatever reason, you kind of do feel like a mopes. Like a mopes could become a term for, you know, entering into some new avenue and just feeling like you are absolutely being left behind because, you know, possibly because you actually do have a moral compass where it seems like everyone else is getting ahead because they don't. I've been there in various things, so I think being a mopes should be a term, part of the pop culture nomenclature.
I think, much like Death to Smoochie, this podcast is getting a little heavy, my friend.
Is it getting heavy? Is it getting kind of heavy? Getting kind of heavy. Well, I mean, let's look at this. We could do just a whole podcast about house music. That would be.
Well, we could just do a whole podcast of I Got the Power. Just like 45 minutes of that shit.
Wait, isn't that song 45 minutes long?
No, it just feels that way.
Oh, okay, that's what I thought. So this cast, I mean, we got Robin Williams and Edward Norton. We also have Catherine Keener, Danny DeVito, who also directed, Jon Stewart of The Daily Show, Harvey Fierstein, and Vincent Schiavelli. Harvey Fierstein playing the head of an organization called the Parade of Hope, which is on the surface a charity that benefits children. But he's basically, it's a front for all of his gangster, he plays a gangster, first of all. Harvey Fierstein, yeah. The least likely person on the planet to ever play a gangster.
I think that's why Joke is.
That is why Joke is, but he does it so well. Yeah. Like, you buy it, and it's strange how much you buy it.
Well, once you start hearing the voice, there's not much you can really do.
T-shirts, snow cones, I want it all. And it's just like, okay, I'll buy it. I don't know why, but I do. So kudos to you, Harvey Fierstein. And then, of course, Jon Stewart playing a particularly weaselly character, which I haven't run across very much with Jon Stewart in film. I mean, it's not like he has a vast catalog to choose from, but it's still seems a little bit of a departure from the roles he normally takes.
I don't know. You know, you consider his role in Half-Baked, where he's the high conspiracy guy. You know.
Oh yes.
Have you ever watched it on weed? he was always doing oddball stuff, and then, you know, he nailed it. I mean, Jon Stewart's career has always been weird. I mean, he's, you know, I've been following him since back in the late '80s when he was on Short Attention Span Theater, which was just a clip show that showed stand up comedy clips on one of the comedy networks. And then he moved over to MTV and got his own talk show, and then that went apart, and he started doing a few roles in movies, and then eventually he wound up up, you know, with the gig taking over for Kilborn, right? Craig Kilborn over at the Daily Show. Mm-hmm. And then created what we now know as the Daily Show, because the Daily Show when Kilborn was on was nothing like what it is now. And right. and under Jon Stewart's stewardship, if you will. He turned that into the show that we all know as the great satire that it is. But so whenever he shows up and does weird stuff, it doesn't surprise me. He's got that movie coming out that he directed here shortly, and it will not surprise me if it is fucking weird as shit. So I don't, you know, someone else out there going, no, it's not. But because I know nothing about it except that Stewart directed it. Stewart directed it, and I'm going to watch it. So, but yeah, he's always been all over the map. So it's really hard to pin down. So I when he showed up in this, I was like, oh, it's awesome. Jon Stewart's here and he's there and then he's gone and he takes it on the chin whenever anybody brings the movie up.
I loved
which
it
they do.
When he hosted the Oscars and he said, I'm your host, Jon Stewart, fourth male lead in Death to Smoochie, go rent it. I was like, I would be proud of that. I'm sorry. Maybe it's just my
fondness for this film.
My overbearing fondness for this film, but I think that's the badge of honor. Here's an interesting thing about this cast that I didn't realize. At one point, Jim Carrey was supposed to star in this, but dropped out to do The Majestic. But it's not clear which role he was supposed to have. I mean, I would assume... I don't know. I don't know if it would be the Sheldon Mopes character or the Rainbow Randolph character.
I imagine it would probably be Mopes.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is back in the era when he was still the lovable lead. Mm-hmm. And you don't give the villain role to you know, your lovable lead actor. Hmm. And I would be surprised because I can't imagine DeVito wanting anybody but Robin Williams to play that role, because man, was he made for that fucking role.
Well, let me give you a quick rundown of the plot if you haven't seen Death to Smoochie. At the beginning of the movie, Robin Williams' character Rainbow Randolph is really the toast of children's television. He's the biggest star in that industry, and he's just making bank, and he's writing his own rules to the point, however, that he begins to extort money from the parents of the way his show is set up is like it's on a big stage and there are all these kids that kind of dance around with him. And he starts extorting money from parents so that their kids get to be more prominently featured on the show. And he gets busted by the FBI, which causes this huge scandal. He gets thrown out on his ass, and the network decides that they are going to look for someone of impeccable morals, someone who can really bring back a squeaky clean image. Not that their company is squeaky clean, but it could at least put a squeaky clean face on it. So they come across in their old resume book a guy named Sheldon Mopes, who does a character named Smoochie the Rhino, and currently he is performing for heroin addicts at the methadone clinic.
Oh, we'll get you off that smackle, yes we will. Oh, we'll get you off that smackle, yes we will. Oh, we're gonna get you off that smack. We'll kick that monkey right off your back and get your life on track. Oh, yes, we will.
But they know that he is a guy with, I think, Jon Stewart. There's never been a whiff of controversy with this guy, so we need him. So they kind of bring him in, and they just kind of supplant Rainbow Randolph by putting Smoochie the Rhino in there. And, of course, that becomes a big hit because you put it in front of enough kids' eyes, it's going to be a big hit. And then it's really about Sheldon's battles, not only with internally what the network is trying to do versus his edutainment type platform, but also with this Parade of Hope nefarious organization and what they want. And then, of course, Rainbow Randolph has been driven insane by the whole situation and is trying to get rid of Mopes one way or another. So that's kind of where we jump into the story.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun to watch Mopes be a part of a conflict that he never really intended to be. Like he gets threatening phone calls from Rainbow Randolph.
You better grow eyes in the back of your fucking head, you horned piece of shit, because I'm not gonna sleep until worms are crawling up your foam rubber ass. I'm going on safari, motherfucker. Safari.
Ben just hangs up the phone and is just like, well, how do you like that? Like, he has no idea how to deal with this completely absurd and really seedy world of children's television.
It's a rocket ship!
It's a rocket ship! That's probably my favorite point of sabotage, that Rainbow Randolph bakes up a big batch of cock cookies for a segment on the live taping.
Cockies, if you will.
Cockies, yeah.
Fresh baked chocolate chip cockies.
I don't like that joke, so I have to say boo cockies. Sorry, I just cracked myself up. That's basically what happens all the time. So yeah, that's my favorite bit of Sabotage. Is he knows that Smoochie has a segment where he pulls cookies out of a bag, so he bakes up a big batch of cockies, and then Smoochie's holding it up on camera and just like, oh, it's a rocket ship.
and that's one of those great, it's one of those great moments of innocence with Mopes, because the thing is he knows what it is,
yeah,
but he also can't acknowledge it, and he can't give into it, because he can't do that in front of the kids,
right?
And so he's like, it's a rocket ship, which of course leads Rainbow Randolph to run out and start yelling, it's a penis, it's a fucking cock, and of course losing his shit on television once again. And this slow descent of Rainbow Randolph is just every bit as dark as you would expect from a Danny DeVito movie, and it just keeps getting getting more and more vile, and it gets even more delightful as the movie goes on.
It really does.
But Robin Williams is going full Robin Williams in this, which is why I think, you know, that role must have been for him and not Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
It's possible they could have wanted Carrey for that role, but I don't think it would have worked the same way.
Oh, it absolutely wouldn't have worked.
Because, you know, I think Carrey would have been much funnier in the... but I think Edward Norton is perfect for that role. Edward Norton just really... This is in Edward Norton's heyday, when he was doing no wrong. And this was the first movie that most people thought was bad that he made. But then there were those of us that disagreed, as we keep saying. He was still going full at it, and he just owns this role. And these two guys just play off each other so well.
Yeah. I mean, what I find particularly inspired about Edward Norton's performance is how, even as he's playing this sort of broadly drawn, he's a man far too sweet and pure to actually exist on this planet, not just in this industry that's depicted, but on this planet. And yet he manages to keep that character genuine, like as broadly drawn and as almost, you know, it is a satire, basically, of sort of an Innocence Lost, Babe in the Woods type character. And yet you never for a second doubt that he, you know, it's absolutely genuine. You never doubt it. And then Robin Williams, on the opposite end of that spectrum, is as manic and animated as ever. And I even like that he kind of ups his slapstick game a little bit. Even in this, you know, this darker movie, he's doing a lot of slapstick. But he is also oddly sympathetic. Like, your heart kind of goes out to him. Even in his most vile moments, you're just like, this is a guy at the end of his rope. This is a guy that has made mistakes, absolutely, and is continuing to make the worst possible decisions. But you kind of feel for the guy. You kind of feel for somebody who feels like their entire life has been taken away from them, and now they're just trying to, they've kind of focused all of their energy on getting rid of the person that they feel is responsible. And I don't know. I think it's a really interesting duality that even at his most vile, there's still something very sympathetic about Rainbow Randolph. And I think that's a testament to Williams' performance.
Well, it is, but it's also very much a hallmark of Danny DeVito's work. Danny DeVito, you know, is very fond of making these dark films with these very, very dark, sad, tragic characters that do have that spark of interesting in them that you can feel some compassion for, that you can feel for, even when they're doing these horrible, despicable things. And honestly, I feel like that's why DeVito is so maligned as a director. In that he really does create these characters that you want to like and can't for all these variety of reasons, and just turns most audiences off because they're not looking for that kind of dark comedy. They want broad comedy. They want it to all end well, and DeVito's movies don't.
Yeah, yeah, and yet it's interesting how it's able to strike a balance between being dark and being satirical and actually having something to say about the entertainment industry, about big business, and yet has characters like Spinner, who is a former boxer and is very sweet-natured and completely out of his mind. I mean, he's basically a Tex Avery cartoon character.
Yeah.
And so it's very clear just from the existence of characters like Spinner and the fact that Harvey Fierstein is playing a gangster that this isn't, I mean, like, it's just broad enough to remind you that it is in fact a comedy and not get so bogged down in reality that you feel like you're just being hammered by bleakness. And I don't know, I like the balance that it strikes.
Yeah, well, it's great theater of the absurd.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. I think by the time you're watching Robin Williams doing an interesting impression of Gene Kelly dancing through the streets when he feels like he's finally bested Smoochie by convincing everyone that Smoochie is a Nazi in one of the film's greater moments. You know, but when you're watching him dance around the street and say things to babies like, "Hello, little nipple nibbler, the rhino's a Nazi," and bounce off walls and, you know, skate across park benches, it's just... It's clear that it is, in fact, like you said, theater of the absurd in the best possible way. Yeah. And I also like that the movie the movie has a really interesting message about fads. When you watch this montage where, you know, anytime there's a scandal, that's how quickly they clean up the set and set up a new one. Like, the next character, the next icon that they're going to trot out and make money off of is immediately in place. No matter how popular the new thing is, it can be swept aside and replaced in moments if there is a whiff of controversy. And they play that up with some rather interesting montages. As far as Robin Williams, though, there is something that I noticed in this viewing that kind of struck me. There's a scene in which Rainbow Randolph douses himself in gasoline and has this soliloquy about how the only person who can take his life is he himself. And I know it's just an unfortunate coincidence that, you know, Williams ended up taking his own life, but that scene is a little tough to watch in hindsight.
Well, it's, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence at all. You know, Williams has spoke a number of times about his suicidal tendencies and about how tough it was and how he got through it. So I think very much that was him tapping into that darkness that he had, that he was very open about. And I don't think he was as open about it in this era, but in the subsequent decade, since this movie came out, he's been very open about that. And which is why, you know, when he did kill himself, so many people were like, "Well, shit." And one of the things that you know got passed around were videos of him talking about how to, about what it's like to be lonely and understanding, but saying you have to know there's people out there that love you, that, you know, that do this, and I got through this, you can get through this. And frankly, I find that stuff kind of harder to watch than I do this, you know, that sequence, because that sequence, you know, that was comedy coming, you know, that's comedy as art. That was the tears of the clown, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, it was really, him channeling that darkness into a really kind of wonderful, absurd piece, that, you know, as history looks at it, just has, you know, was sad prophecy.
Yeah. And the other oddly prophetic moment in the film is this is in a lesser degree for sure, is the death of the character Buggy Ding Dong. Buggy's played by Vincent Schiavelli, who is a guy if you don't know that name, I guarantee you know his face. He is one of the most prolific character actors, I think, that we've had in the last generation or so, and he passed 3 years after this film's release. But he plays this former child star, not child star, this children's entertainer who was, they mentioned in the film, was basically fired for his heroin addiction, and they hire him late in the film to take out Smoochie the Rhino at the world's most ridiculous ice capades. If you've ever sat through as a kid. If you ever sat through one of the Disney on Ice shows and just how...
Or like some of us who are old enough to have seen Snorks on Ice.
Oh my God. Are you serious?
Yes.
Okay.
I've seen Snorks on Ice.
Wait. Was it as good as Smurfs on Ice except that it was underwater?
It was essentially the biggest Smurfs ripoff you've ever seen, but on ice. It was kind of amazing. Snorks and Smurfs are very different.
No.
One lives in mushrooms and are blue, and the other breathe through the top of their head and live underwater in things that are definitely not mushrooms.
Yes. Yeah, they breathe from dildos attached to the tops of their heads, so that's What were you talking about?
Snorks on Ice. But you were actually going off on the Ice Capades assassination sequence.
Yes,
I derailed you and melted your brain with the fact that not only did Snorks on Ice exist, but I have seen it.
I need to find a video of Snorks on Ice. I just need to know what the hell that looks like. And you kind of need to see the scene of Smoochie on Ice to understand what the hell is going on here. It's hard to explain. He has taken, like, Sheldon has always been, you know, Sheldon is a guy that resists at every turn the over marketing or the over capitalization of children's television. So he's very much against, like, Smoochie brand soda because it's got too many, you know, it's got too much refined sugar. He's against Ice Capades in general because he sees them as just a way to peddle cheap souvenirs and sugary snacks. So when he finally gets his way, he gives away all of the souvenirs, and all the food is paid for and free for everybody, and it's all organic and eco-safe and all that other garbage. And then they hire Vincent Schiavelli to basically snipe him from the rafters during this Ice Capades. And as the plot is foiled and Vincent Schiavelli's character is falling from the catwalk, he says, his last words are, "I never saw Venice." And what's weird about that is Vincent Schiavelli passed away 3 years later in Italy. So it's just a couple of very bizarre,
in Venice?
Not in Venice. I think it was in Sicily. But
perhaps he never saw Venice.
Perhaps he still never saw Venice. We don't know. But luckily, if Ghost has taught us anything, he'll still have the chance to travel there and really fuck with Patrick Swayze. So no. I like to believe that
he would not fuck with Patrick Swayze because Patrick Swayze was the one that did the fucking.
Right. But you remember he was the guy that was like, "How can you see me?" And then Patrick Swayze's like, "How are you able to touch things?" And it was, you know, almost like a Yoda relationship with Vincent Schiavelli and Ghost. What were we talking about? Were we talking about Ghost or Death to Smoochie?
Death to Smoochie.
Death to Smoochie.
you are really all about the tangents tonight. You are getting derailed like a motherfucker.
It has been a very long day. I'm getting easily derailed. But yeah, Death to Smoochie is one of those movies that is gonna challenge you a little bit because it is so bizarre. You know, it's a mixed bag of things. It's
not an easy film.
It's not an easy film.
It's not an accessible film. But if you're the type of person that loves absurdist comedy and loves dark absurdist comedy, this is really one of those great gems. And it's sadly unloved. And we're probably going to catch some hell from listeners who are like, "How dare you? You know, you talk about the glory of Megaforce and you soil that by telling us that Death to Smoochie is watchable."
Totally is, though.
It really, you know, the people that love it really love it. And we're in that camp. It's just a very, very funny movie.
It really is. And like I said, it's going to really mess with your head if you grew up on Sesame Street, or you grew up with Captain Kangaroo, or if you grew up with, you know, because those are supposed to be havens. You know, they're supposed to be havens for wonder and imagination and all things in good and righteous. And then you have this movie that just comes in to remind you that it's all still business and it's all still very much a marketplace. And I mean, it goes to great lengths to exaggerate, obviously, because it is a theater of the absurd. But at the same time, it is a little bit on point with its messages of you know, the nature of fads and the entertainment industry in general. And I mean, Sheldon's story is almost like, it's almost like the children's entertainment version of Job, where it's like you have this guy who at every turn people are trying to corrupt. I mean, they're basically dropping the ceiling on him again and again and again, and he just can't stop being sweet and pure throughout all of this. So I think that's sort of the great juxtaposition to the complete lack of purity in the approach to how they depict children's television, is that there is still that one guy who refuses to compromise a single one of his principles, which again makes him a character that probably doesn't exist on this planet. But the great thing about Death to Smoochie is by the end of it, we like to believe that in fact he does. And then the movie ends with one of the most adorable credit sequences you'll ever see.
It's pretty great.
It's, you know, it's Smoochie, it's Randolph, and they're dancing around and they're skating and they're playing Your Love Is Lifting Me Higher. It's such a sweet ending to a very
to your love lifting me higher.
Yes.
Than I've ever been lifted before.
Shake it, baby.
And what other movie does that play a central role?
That would be the great Ghostbusters 3.
Ghostbusters 2.
Ghostbusters 2. They have not made Ghostbusters 3 yet, and I actually hope that they don't. But damn it, derailed again.
There you go. Now you've got images of a strutting a Statue of Liberty in your head.
No, well, that's pretty normal, actually. That happens to me a lot. If you like your comedies a little bit darker, if you like the idea of Barney the dinosaur accidentally getting caught at a Klan rally in New Jersey, if that image makes you giggle even a little bit, I think you will find plenty to like about Death to Smoochie. So before we get into our last segment of the show with the junk food pairing specifically for Death to Smoochie, it felt fitting to go ahead and talk about some of our favorite, our other favorite Robin Williams films, and just, you know, just kind of put that out there in the universe. So, Cargo, I'm going to let you go first.
Well, you know, the one that had it the biggest impact on me, I don't know if I would absolutely call it my favorite, but the one that affected me the most is Dead Poets Society.
Oh, absolutely.
And I just, you know, I saw that movie when I was a teenager and I was a young writer, and it really kicked me in the ass and got me writing a lot of stuff. And Robin Williams is so great in that, you know, young Ethan Hawke, really young, talented cast of guys. But Robin Williams is just, it's one of those, it's from that era when he started doing much more serious films, but still had a comedy angle to it, leading to one of my other favorites, which is Good Morning Vietnam.
Sure.
Which, you know, his Adrian Cronauer, it was so great. It was one of those things where, you know, at the time, the soundtrack to it, was a big hit because it had several of his bits in between all the music that he played. So you had this cassette that was essentially an Adrian Cronauer show, which was really cool and had bits from the movie. And I listened to that tape till it broke. I mean, it was really fantastic.
That was your awesome mix.
It was my awesome mix for a while. It's a really, really good, really good movie with a great soundtrack. But those two movies in particular, I think those were really kind of the turning point for him, where he, you know, he was doing oddball stuff. He was trying to hit the mainstream, and that's where he really kind of first hit big with, you know, mainstream feature films that really kind of connected with everyone, and everyone wanted to see Robin Williams movies. And he did a couple other really cool stuff. I like Awakenings, which was really great. You know, that whole era of his stuff is really fantastic. Death to Smoochie, of course, is one of my absolute favorites of his. And I really like World's Greatest Dad.
The Bobcat Goldthwait movie.
The Bobcat Goldthwait movie. It's a movie that you're watching that movie, and the first, the first 90% of the movie, you're just like, it's just a train wreck. And it's just like, oh my God. Oh, and you're waffling on the verge of whether you love or hate it. And it's like, this is good, but I really don't like where it's going. And then it takes a turn that's so fucking good that you're just like, and the ending of that movie just redeems everything that happens and makes that journey so worthwhile. That it just made me fall in love with that film, and it's a dark, hard watch the first time, but it's so worth it at the end.
Right on. Well, I one of his films that I rewatch the most, and it's not even one that I don't know, maybe favorite was the wrong word to lead into this, but the movie that I can't seem to stop watching, and whenever it's on, I stop what I'm doing and watch just to marvel at how bizarre it really is Toys.
Oh, like, God, Toys is so weird.
It's such a, like, nothing about its existence makes any sense whatsoever. And you watch that and you just keep thinking, I don't know who this movie was made for.
Yeah, Drew McWeeny actually has has written a series of articles on it because he followed it very closely. And even he, knowing all he knows about the background of all the weird shit that was happening making that film, even he can't really wrap his mind around it. And he's talked about that. It is just, it's such an oddity. And the people that love that movie are few and far between, but man, do they love the shit out of
it. I'm fascinated by it. I don't even know exactly where I fall on the like-love continuum of that film, but I am fascinated by it. Now, a movie I know of his that I know I absolutely love is The Birdcage.
Oh, God, yes.
I mean, that is just like, that is the one that when I declared that Death to Smoochie was my favorite of his comedies, the only thing that really made that decision tough was The Birdcage, because The Birdcage is so damn good. It's obviously the English version of La Cage aux Folles, and it's him and Nathan Lane just playing a very, like, just absolutely lovable gay couple, And for Robin Williams, you know, I mean, there's been speculation, whatever, but, you know, just from everything that I know about him, which is very little, but I mean, for a straight actor to play a gay man pretending to be straight, like, that's a really interesting challenge for a performer to like transcend that many levels. And I think he does it with such aplomb, and he makes those characters so real, and he makes his relationship with Nathan Lane feel very real. And throughout the whole movie, for all the absurd things that are going on, it's a farce. It's very larger than life. I like the whole movie for me is grounded by his performance, and I think he's absolutely phenomenal in it.
Well, yeah, no, he's amazing in it. And he actually spoke about that in his AMA earlier this year on Reddit. Oh. Someone asked him about what it was like on set. And one of the things he mentioned is how hilarious Hank Azaria was in that.
Oh, yeah.
And how, you know, it was so hard to not laugh whenever he was around, because he's just so funny. And I've always loved watching comedians talk about how hard it is to be around other comedians who just make them laugh all the time. Mm-hmm. There's just something really heartwarming about that. And just the way he spoke about his fondness for that film and the very, how funny everyone working on that film was. And that film is just, it's one of those that, it's so good.
Definitely.
And I love that they never went forward with making any of the sequels the way, you know, the French did. And they just kind of left it at one perfect comedy.
Absolutely. And then, of course, I mean, Good Will Hunting, you know, that's a no-brainer. And then Aladdin was probably the Disney film that meant the most to me as a kid. It was the one that, it's the first one I really remember seeing in theaters. And it's one that obviously the clamshell VHS got worn out more than a few times. The songs were all ones that I knew by heart. I played the video game relentlessly. Like, it was a movie that really...
Prince of Persia is not the Aladdin video game.
No, it's not at all. I would rather play a defective version of the Aladdin video game for Sega Genesis than have to sit through Prince of Persia again. Yeah, kill screen and all. But yeah, no, I mean, it's just like, it's not just one. There's so many performances that he's doing in one movie that it's spectacular to behold. And like all of the references, and it's very much a movie that, even though, you know, there are some behind the scenes stories of him having to kind of tone it down a bit because he would get going and he would start riffing and then he would forget that it was a Disney film.
Oh, yeah.
And go a little bit blue with some of the comedy. And yet still, like, it's still a movie that really caters towards his type of stand-up thing, where it really was just like, you know what? And I think that's kind of why it's appropriate that I went off on so many tangents during this show, is because that's a Robin Williams thing.
It's not, you never went fussy, so you never quite went to full Robin Williams. It's not full you haven't gone full Robin Williams until you have...
Gay Preacher.
Yes. that is exactly where I was going with that. Until you go to Bob Fosse. You know, one of the things I'll mention is one of my favorite, absolute favorites is Robin Williams live on Broadway.
Oh, hell yeah.
All of his big long stand-up comedies, comedy specials were fantastic, but that one in particular was really, really great. And it has a series of jokes that always made me want to hear him interviewed and talk about Lance Armstrong, which he never did. Because he was one of Lance Armstrong's staunchest defenders. And then the minute Lance Armstrong admitted that he was doping, Williams just very polite, you know, he made a nice little statement about feeling disappointed and then just very politely backed out of, Lance Armstrong's stuff.
Yeah.
But man, Live on Broadway is so fucking funny. I mean, that entire, if you've never listened to that stand up bit, you need to see that performance. I mean, it is all gold. It is just all gold from beginning to end.
Yeah. And I would also recommend tracking down his appearance on Inside the Actor's Studio.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's this great bit where James Lipton asks him why he's so good at improv, and whether it's that his mind is just working faster than everybody else's, or is it just that he never turns it off? And then he immediately takes a pink scarf from a woman in the audience and does like 8 minutes of comedy just about this scarf. And it's so incredible to watch. And I remember when I was first watching Inside the Actor Studios when I thought I was going to be an actor. Like I started college in the theater department, and you know that's what I wanted to do. And so I would watch every single episode of Inside the Actor Studio and just try and glean as much as I could. And that episode just really knocked me on my ass, and I rewatched it again and again and again and again, because he was just such a magnificent talent at what he did that it was almost preternatural. Like, it was incredible to watch him just riff from joke to joke to joke, and it was all gold. Like, I couldn't believe it that, you know, none of it was scripted. He was just doing it off the top of his head, and that's just the kind of comedian he was. So, of course, that brings us to the junk food pairing.
If this is not a cock cookie, I'm going to be really, really upset.
If you happen to live in a town or city too conservative to allow for the establishment of an erotic bakery, you can purchase phallic-shaped cookie cutters online or make your own with a pair of scissors and a tinfoil baking pan. On YouTube, there is a video that teaches you how to make your own cookie cutters. Now, they don't specifically tell you how to make cock-shaped cookie cutters.
Have you tried?
But I haven't tried either. You should really
Google that and then clear your browser history.
Yes. I want to be the Martha Stewart of dicks. Like, I want to be able to teach you how to make all sorts of dick-related or dick-shaped things. I really feel like this is opening the door to a whole new career.
I think I have a new nickname for you.
I don't want to
hear it. You are the Martha Stewart of dicks.
No, that's fine. the Martha Stewart of dicks, that's me. So if you have to make your own, or if you order it online, what you're going to end up with are cock-shaped sugar cookies, the sweet treat that your friends might be too uncomfortable to eat. And if they are, if they just can't fathom the idea of putting a phallus into their mouth, just tell them that it's not a cock, but a rocket ship.
It's a rocket ship!
It's a rocket ship.
And paralleling the movie, a genital-shaped cookie of any kind is a wonderful perversion of something so sweet and innocent as dessert. So not only is it a callback to one of the best scenes in the movie, but I think it adequately sums up the movie itself.
And to quote the village people, anyone who can put a ding-dong and two snowballs in their mouth can accomplish anything.
This is something we will talk about soon, is your choice of birthday film and how it affected me in an interesting way. Well, that's going to do it for Junk Food Cinema. I'm very sorry that we talked about dicks so much.
No, you're not.
Well, you know, we're going to lose the listeners in Nebraska, I feel, if we keep talking about
it. I think they have dicks, too.
I know, but, you know, I don't want to upset all the good and innocent people of the Corn Belt. The Corn Belt. That should have been the name of the show. Anyway, this is Brian Salisbury. You can find me on Twitters at BriGuySalisbury. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at twitter.com/...
No, just twitter.com.
Just Twitter. You go to twitter.com. That's where I am.
You're the Twitter overlord.
At Massaworm, MassaWyrm. You could also find me on Facebook. Facebook/MassaWyrm.
Oh, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And of course, we will have a link to where you can buy this week's movie, Death to Smoochie, on Amazon. And if you do that, if you click on that link, even if you don't buy Death to Smoochie, which you really should.
You really should.
If you buy anything on Amazon, as long as you got there from our link, you're actually benefiting the show. So we really do appreciate you doing that. And we're on iTunes and on the Stitchers, all over the interwebs. So, yeah, we just wanted to come together and talk about one of our favorite Robin Williams films. It's a little offbeat, perhaps. It's not a popular choice, but it is a film that is garnering every year a larger and larger cult audience. And it is my hope that... with the passing of Robin Williams, people will want to go back through his catalog and if nothing else, just for the reason of being a completionist, watch the things that they haven't seen.
Like Moscow on the Hudson,
or maybe things they haven't even heard of. And, you know, this is one of those things you're going to come across. It may hit you weird at first, but I guarantee you, if you give it a chance, this is a film that's really going to make you laugh in ways that you might not be comfortable with, but still you will be laughing. So that's going to do it for Junk Food Cinema. For Cargo, this is Brian reminding you that you can't change the world, but you can make a dent.
Good night!